Dimitri Christakis, MD, FAAP, is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington and director of the Center for Child Health Behavior and Development at Seattle Children's Research Institute. Ari Brown, MD, FAAP, is a pediatrician in private practice in Austin, Texas, and was the lead author on the AAP policy statement, Media Use by Children Younger Than 2 Years. We'd like to focus on media use in very young children from birth to age 2. Dr. Christakis, can you talk about how early experiences impact young children's brain development?
The interesting thing is that we're actually born with our brains not fully formed. In fact, the newborn brain triples in size in the first 2 years of life. And it does that in direct response to external stimulation. The mind is fine-tuned to the world that babies are born into. And there's a critical period early on where that environment leads to long-term functional differences. So as an example, any child born anywhere in the world can learn to speak any language fluently. But if they're not exposed to certain sounds early in life, even though they can learn to speak a second language fluently later in life, they'll never sound like a native speaker. So a baby born in mainland China today can learn to speak fluent Mandarin, but if she doesn't hear English on a regular basis, she'll never be able to sound like a native English speaker later in life, struggling to make certain sounds we're all familiar with, like rolling her R's. It's not because she wasn't born with that ability. It's because early on, her mind determined there was no need for her to make those sounds, and she lost the capacity that she otherwise would have had. So those early experiences, whether it's with language, acquisition, or any kind of early learning environment, has long-term implications.
We know that infants and toddlers need stimulation for brain development, but what is the right kind of stimulation? And does too much of the wrong kind of stimulation actually harm the brain?
If you think of the newborn brain as a work in progress that is fine-tuning itself to the world in which it's going to live, the kinds of early experiences that infants have shape the mind for later tasks. So we know from decades of research that so-called good stimulation leads to improved function. There have been studies, for example, done in mice where you raise them in enriched environments and then test them compared to control mice with their ability to learn mazes or to perform the kinds of tasks that assess mouse intelligence. And mice raised in enriched environments not only perform better on those tests, but if you look at their brains under the microscope, you see that their cortex is actually richer, denser, larger than the control mice. Now, obviously, we don't do those kinds of studies in humans, but observational studies have shown the same thing. So, for example, children born, or rather raised in the Romanian orphanages, which were profoundly neglected early in their lives, didn't develop certain capacities at all later in their life, and in fact weren't capable of learning later as a result of significant deprivation. So we know from both observational and experimental studies that early stimulation is key, but it has to be the right kind of stimulation. It has to be the kind of stimulation that helps the brain develop to function in the real world that children will live in. And for some time, in my lab, we've been concerned about what we call the overstimulation hypothesis. What this means is that if you overstimulate the developing brain or inappropriately stimulate the developing brain, it can lead to problems with attention later in life because the brain comes to expect that hyper level of stimulation that can't be achieved under normal circumstances. And as a result, school-aged children find real-paced events boring. They're underwhelming, and they have difficulty in what we call executive function.
By overstimulation, do you mean certain types of TV shows?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So the overstimulation hypothesis is not per se limited to television, although that's the model we've used to study it. But think of it this way. Our brains evolved over millennia to process events that happen in the real world. And events that happen in the real world, by definition, take place in real time, right? You can't have something happen in the real world faster than it could happen in the real world. The exception to that is, of course, media, which make it very possible to speed things up, to create surreal pacing and overstimulation that can't be achieved in the normal experience of a developing baby. The kinds of stimulations that for years parents have provided to their children, whether it's speaking to them, talking with them, interacting with them, all of those things are good and by definition are taking place in normal time.
Dr. Brown, what does the Academy recommend regarding media use in this very young age group of children?
In 1999, the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a policy statement informing parents about media effects on children, and at that point discouraged television viewing for children under 2 years of age. Although there was limited data, we believe there were more potential negative effects of media than positive ones in this age group, and so we encourage families to thoughtfully consider media use for very young children. We came back and looked at this question this past year because the concerns are even more relevant today because children have more access to screens. And we answered two key questions. One was, do video or televised programs have any educational value for kids under age 2? And what we found is that answer is no. And is there any harm in children under age 2 watching these programs? And the concern is yes, there are some developmental effects that we find are concerning enough to recommend to parents that it's probably best to do something else with your child's time than to have them sitting in front of a television and watching a program.
Dr. Brown, some parents have really come to rely on videos, especially on car trips or in an airplane or even just making dinner. What's wrong with using screens to entertain your child during these times?
As a pediatrician, I have many parents who say they just want to put their child in front of a TV so they can take a shower or cook dinner. And I'm a parent too, and I get it. And we know that you can't keep your child away from screens 100% of the time. And we know that you can't sit down with your child 24/7 and play with them. But what we want people to realize is that kids can really make valuable use of that free time or downtime when they're engaged in independent play, because that's really important time for them to problem solve and use their brains in a creative way. And when you're busy doing another task and your child is sitting in the same room doing something by themselves, you're more likely to talk to them while you're engaged in activity, and that talk time is very important. And what we found is that when a television is on or a screen is on, the child is engaged in watching that program, and the parent is talking to their child 80% less of the time. And that talking time is actually really critical for a child's language development, because hearing the words and hearing their parent talking to them is really helping them understand the language and grow their communication skills. Making use of those times when you're busy doing something else is really valuable time for your child.
I would just add to what Dr. Brown says. I agree with it. And I think that the problem isn't the mom or dad who needs 15 minutes to collect themselves to take a shower. I think that level of exposure doesn't give me reason to be concerned. But the reality is that it's much more time than that. The typical baby is watching 1 to 2 hours a day.
Dr. Christakis, can you talk about the content of videos and television? Do different types of video content produce different health effects in children? For example, I remember watching Mr. Rogers, which is very different from some modern cartoons.
First of all, I just want to reiterate that we're talking about children 0 to 2 now and not older children, for which there are many, many good shows. As Dr. Brown said, there really is no evidence at all for children under the age of 2 of any educational benefit, even of shows that have been shown to be good for older children, like Mr. Rogers or like Sesame Street. But the reality is that the shows that are marketed to infants specifically have very, very rapid pacing. They're surreally sequenced. In fact, they're much more rapidly, much more frenetically edited than shows that are designed for older children and even for adults. And the reason for that is because young children, 6, 9-month-old children, can't actually follow a narrative on the screen. What keeps them engaged is what we call the formal features of the medium, which is just those editing elements. And it's that editing that creates a pacing that is surreal. Mr. Rogers is a terrific show, and in fact, takes place very much like reality TV. There are really only two sets to it. There's his house, his primarily his living room, and then the land of make-believe, and then occasionally he goes on a field trip. But all of that happens in real time if you watch the show. In fact, to be honest, it happens in surreally slow time. It's not overly stimulating by any stretch. To be totally candid, if my hypothesis is ultimately proven, or the work that we've done so far is further substantiated, it would suggest that a show like Mr. Rogers doesn't increase the risk of attentional problems later on, but that infants won't actually watch Mr. Rogers with much interest at all because it's nothing different than what might be happening around them.
Dr. Brown, is there anything you'd like to add about these videos that are marketed as educational for toddlers?
In our research of the literature for this new policy statement, what we found is that these programs get lost in translation for kids under age 2. There are some 18-month-olds who understand what's happening on the screen, but if you look at all comers, kids under age 2 don't get it, and by age 2, suddenly the light turns on and the kids do start to understand the content. And as Dr. Christakis said, it can be very educational. A program like Sesame Street has been proven to be educational. Kids do learn some academic things, and they learn some social things too, good social behaviors from Sesame Street. But kids under 2, it simply gets lost in translation, and it's because they can't understand the content or the context of what's happening on the screen. Entertaining, yes. Educational, no. You really need to be an informed consumer. These programs are often marketed, whether explicitly or implicitly, that they're educational for babies. And so parents sometimes will buy these DVDs so that their kids can learn or get a leg up. And that's really not going to happen.
Dr. Christakis, is there a better way to stimulate brain development?
I like to think about what I call the direct and indirect effects of media exposure, really at all ages, but in the case of infants especially. The direct effects is some of what we've been talking about here, mediated specifically through the content of the show. How is it affecting them positively or negatively, what they're actually watching? But the indirect effects are mediated primarily through displacement. In other words, the time spent in front of the screen comes at the expense of doing something else. And what might that other thing be? Dr. Brown mentioned even sitting on the kitchen floor while your parents are cooking dinner. That's meaningful time. It's certainly more meaningful than time spent in sitting idly in front of a screen. We always have to think about what the alternative to viewing is. And most of the alternative activities, even if they don't seem educational to parents, actually have real value.
Dr. Christakis, what about apps and computer games for this young age group? Does the interactive nature of these games make them a better option?
The short answer, which is frustrating, I'm sure, for parents and, for that matter, for pediatricians, is we don't have definitive scientific evidence one way or the other. We can't keep pace with the rapid technological changes. These apps simply didn't exist for babies 3 years ago, and now they're everywhere. But if you want my expert opinion, I actually don't think that they pose the same risks at all. I should point out, of course, that with all of these things, we have to be very careful because we always talk about screen time as if it's all the same. An app could, in effect, be no different than watching a movie on an iPad. If you're watching the equivalent of a TV on an iPad, then the effects would be the same. But if it is these interactive kinds of apps, I don't have the same concerns for several reasons. One, they are interactive. And two, they typically aren't so rapidly paced because they actually are trying to engage the child. They have built-in pauses for the child to actually do something and elicit a response. So one of the more popular apps, for example, is this screenshot of various animals, and the toddler touches the animal and it makes the sound that that animal makes in real life. That really isn't that different, frankly, than a toy that many of us grew up with, which had a dial and a series of animals around it, and you would point the dial to an animal and pull a string, and it would spin around and make the sound that that animal made. Now, we could argue about some of the subtleties about manipulating something in three dimensions versus a flat screen, but this is basically an electronic interactive toy simulating the kind of toy that has been around for a long time, and I don't have concerns that that will be damaging in the appropriate dosing. Again, ultimately at high levels, it becomes a matter of displacement. So I don't think that a child should spend 6-7 hours on an iPad, because they're going to be surely missing out on other things which are good for their brain development.
Dr. Brown, would you like to add anything?
I think that the answer is we simply don't know. And unfortunately, technology is a lot faster than science. And so all of these things are out there, and we simply don't have the answers to have a formal position on it yet. But I agree with Dr. Christakis that some of these applications are interactive and are really just simulating other activities that we grew up with as kids. But there will be nothing that can approximate taking two blocks and stacking them on top of each other. You can learn some analytical reasoning skills by moving a block on a screen, but having them in your hands is really priceless. There are certain activities that you just can't do on an app or a computer game, and those toys have been around for generations, and there's a reason for that.
Dr. Brown, let's talk about background media or secondhand TV. What does that mean exactly?
Well, background media or secondhand TV is when a parent has their show on. Parents don't usually think of that as screen time for their child, because they think, oh, well, my child's not watching it. They have no interest in this show. But the truth is that it's very distracting for both the parent and the child. So the parent is going to be talking less to their child because they're watching their show. And the child, who maybe is sitting on the floor and playing with their toys, is actually less focused and more likely to move on from one activity to the next while a TV is on, because they are constantly glancing up at the TV and watching it. And so that actually has been shown in studies, that kids are much less focused and pay attention less to what they're doing. It's not a good use of time for either the parent or the child, because there isn't that interaction going on. There isn't that talk time going on. And the child isn't focusing on their work at hand, which is their playtime. The other thing that's kind of disturbing that came up in our research is that 40% of households will say that the TV is always on, even when no one is watching it, which begs the question, well, why is the TV on in the first place if nobody's watching it? But, you know, that background noise, again, is distracting for everybody in the house. If you want to watch your shows, we'd recommend that you watch them later after your child has gone to bed.
Dr. Brown, do you have some practical tips for parents to help them limit the screen time for their babies and toddlers?
First is turning off your own shows. We're role models for our kids. And so if we don't have our TV on, if we aren't sitting there at the computer or checking our Blackberries or our iPhones, our kids are learning that this is not a significant portion of the day that's so important to have a screen in front of us. So one is to be a good role model, and the other is to really encourage kids to do independent, unstructured free play. And, you know, sometimes we get so wrapped up in thinking we have to sit down and play with our kids all the time, which is really terrific, but we know we can't. Unstructured playtime is really valuable, and that your kids will actually find a way to use just raw materials. You don't need really expensive toys. I mean, just nesting cups, Tupperware, and a wooden spoon. You'd be amazed what a child will do with some of these household items that you have. That time that they're figuring out what to do and entertain themselves is really valuable. So you don't have to feel guilty. In fact, you should feel good about giving your child that free time.
Thinking as parents and as pediatricians, do you each have some final advice you would share with parents?
I always tell parents that they shouldn't feel bad or guilty about their use of media, but they really should use it wisely. And that takes effort. It's never been more difficult to be a parent than it is today. And media provide kind of a very convenient potential solution. But like many things that are convenient, if they're not used prudently, they may not, in fact, be beneficial. They might even be harmful.
What I would say is that kids under age 2 learn best from interacting with people and playing with real objects. It's important to allow them to have that unstructured playtime. But if you are going to have media in your life, no matter what age you start with your children, you need to have a concrete strategy to manage it.